Welcome to the Sanity Interview by the New York Sun. My name is A.R. Hoffman, and every week my co-host, Rebecca Sugar, and I will talk to the people that you want to hear from.
We're joined today by Peter Schweitzer, an 8-time New York Times bestselling author. His most recent books are Blood Money and Red Handed, which are really must-reads for anybody who wants to understand the battle that China has been waging against the West, and in some ways the way the West has been participating in that battle. Another one of his great books was a 2016 book called Clinton Cash, which I really recommend. Peter's the president of the Government Accountability Institute and host of the Drill Down with Peter Schweitzer podcast. Peter, thank you so much for being here with us.
Great to be with both of you. Thanks so much for having me.
Sure.
So I think of you as kind of the OG of DOGE. You've been sort of finding waste and corruption in government and in a lot of areas for a very long time. You've done some tremendous research in these areas. I wanted to just start by asking you how you view DOGE, the work that it has done, what you would have done differently, and do you think that the work that has been done is sustainable? Will it last? Are there systems now in place to help prevent some of the waste, abuse, and fraud that they have uncovered?
Yeah, those are all great questions. I think that DOGE has done incredible work in a lot of respects. Part of that incredible work is just existing and actually doing what they're doing, which is pretty rare in Washington. I mean, I'm old enough to remember back, you know, to the Reagan administration and the so-called Grace Commission, where they were going to make all these changes and they made all these recommendations and nothing happened. DOGE is actually doing it. And for somebody like me who's investigated this stuff in the past, you know, to essentially have access to all the records, you know, to effectively have subpoena power is enormously beneficial. So I give them a lot of credit for that. I think the challenge is twofold. One is when you run across a case of malfeasance, you know, where somebody has actually potentially committed a crime, fraud in some respect, involving this government money, the question is, are they going to be prosecuted? I think that's really the key question, because what we know about corruption in Washington, D.C. is if you let people get away with it, it's going to be imitated. It doesn't matter which political party they're in, you're going to find imitators. So there has to be, I think, some accounting for instances where actual fraud has taken place. So there's the issue of prosecution. The second issue that concerns me is the word you mentioned or the phrase you mentioned earlier, systems in place. DOGE comes in with the authority of the president. What it does not have the ability to do is actually create statutory changes in the manner in which this money is doled out. So, of course, the fear that somebody like me has is some future administration, Republican or Democrat, doesn't matter. Are we going to go back to form where they are sending out cash that oftentimes is done for political purposes rather than for the actual reason that they say the money's being expended for?
Right.
Let me just follow up on that, Peter. Is sort of the way in which DOGE has gone about this strategically the way you would have? And let me break that into two parts. One, you know, sort of the departments and programs and organizations they started with, basically USAID and others, and two, the method by which they sort of cut programs and budgets and all of that. I mean, did anything about that kind of approach surprise you, either positively or negatively?
Well, I tell you, I mean, I'm generally the sort of person who likes to do things methodically. But that said, I think the fact that DOGE has not been necessarily methodical is kind of out of necessity. I think you kind of need a shock and awe approach when you're dealing with this colossus, which is the federal government, the federal bureaucracy, the deep state, whatever you want to call it. So I think the immediacy with which they have been proceeded is the right approach out of necessity. And I have in my mind that there is this sort of clock ticking that is counting down. I think the longer in which you do this, the more difficult it's going to become, because, you know, the deep state is going to rally its resources. They're going to file, you know, cases in federal court. They're going to find a sympathetic judge. So I think the shock and awe approach was necessary. You know, there may have been some missteps. There may have been some exaggerations in some of the things that they released. But I think that's the price you have to pay if you're actually going to be effective. Because let's be clear here, this is not a sort of academic exercise. This is not a process by which there are systems in place to prevent fraud from occurring. If those systems were working, these problems wouldn't exist. So I think you have to, in a sense, treat this as kind of a bureaucratic barroom brawl. And if you know you're going to be taking on three or four guys in a bar, it might make sense to hit one of them with a chair before they're looking. and I think that's kind of what DOGE has done. And I think they had to do that out of necessity.
I want to pick up on the accountability point again, just because you didn't sound terribly optimistic that there would be any. But it strikes me that when we do talk about the discoveries that DOGE has made, we're talking about the agencies, right? USAID, and not so much Samantha Power or anybody else with a name attached. And so if you were the head of DOGE, Peter Schweizer, what would you do to make sure there was accountability? Would you put Samantha Power on trial? Would her deputies, be prosecuted? What's the appropriate accountability position here?
That's a good question. Well, first of all, for me, the issue comes down to can you demonstrate that a crime was committed? I think, of course, the great tragedy of the lawfare against Trump was it had all the sort of definition of, what a dirty cop says, which is says, I found the guy, now I'm going to find the crime. So I think you have to follow the money and you have to follow the instances. I think in a lot of cases, you're going to find it's not even necessarily people in government who have sort of, abided by the rules that are in place. It's the people outside of government that have misappropriated money. And I'll give you one example of the sort of thing that I'm talking about. A lot of what DOGE has done is looked at nonprofit organizations that sometimes received billion-dollar grants from the federal government. And what a lot of nonprofit organizations will do is effectively function as a money laundering operation. And what I mean by that is, let's say I set up a nonprofit organization and I get a $1 billion grant. I'm not going to pay myself a $10 million salary because I have to report that on the 990 form. But what I'm going to do is I'm going to set up a media company. I'm going to set up a fundraising company. I'm going to set up a management company. And the nonprofit's going to hire all of them to perform these various functions. And I'm going to pocket all the money. That's deceptive. I think that's fraudulent. That's the sort of thing that they ought to be looking at. The question is, do we have the willpower in the Department of Justice? Do we have the manpower in terms of the capacity to do those kinds of investigations? Because it's so large. The number of NGOs runs into thousands. The money runs into billions of dollars. So this is a monumental task, and our ability to sort of monitor these funds and the way that they're expended and to see if they're, performing this money laundering role has vastly outstripped our ability to even know where the money is going. So it's a question of political will by the Department of Justice, and it's also a question of capacity. I kind of hope the will is there. Maybe I'm being, unfairly optimistic. The capacity's not there. But again, if you can find a couple of instances and you can make examples of those people, I think that is an important step in trying to return some accountability. Otherwise, this becomes kind of a media exercise, and I don't think anybody wants that.
Yes, you mentioned sort of Congress's role here, which basically has been non-existent. And I think that's posed, that's in some sense liberated DOGE. In other ways, it's posed certain problems. I mean, it's posed constitutional problems, right? There are limits to how much a purely kind of executive branch force can do in terms of statutorily enabled departments. I also think it's raised this issue of, well, who's deciding what gets cut, right? And is there a real kind of democratic small d conversation about, you know, do we want to support HIV treatment in Africa? What are our priorities and where do we cut? So do you have any hope that Congress going forward can play a role in the downsizing of government, or is Congress hopelessly compromised by the very same funds that Musk has been cutting?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think there are probably a few people on Capitol Hill, maybe a couple of dozen, who are genuinely concerned about this. I think the rest of them are either using it as a political tool against their opponents, or they are complicit in it in some way. And this is the problem. You have the financial compromise. You also have what I would call the lack of profiles in courage by people on Capitol Hill who don't want to waddle into these territories. So Congress is a massive problem. But again, that said, I am very supportive of the approach that Jim Comer took as chairman of the House Oversight Committee and their investigation into the Bidens and their relationships to China, Ukraine, and Russia. He had subpoena power. They found the banking records. They showed the flow of money. In my mind, and in the mind of people that actually practice law, there's pretty clear evidence that there was malfeasance that took place, there was lying to Congress, but Congress can't prosecute those. That goes to the Department of Justice. And Jim Comer wrote an 8-page letter to Attorney General Bondi saying, we recommend and believe there are grounds for prosecution in these areas. So congressional oversight is very, very important, and certainly creating legislative action that would maybe fine-tune the manner in which these grants are you know, sent. But let's remember, I mean, our budget is kind of done by continuing resolutions. I mean, Congress doesn't really do budgets. A lot of this stuff is kind of grab bag open, and when you have a situation where, you know, somebody like Stacey Abrams, the former gubernatorial candidate in Georgia, you know, sets up a nonprofit organization that has a budget of $1,000 and the next year is approved in the waning days of the Biden administration, is approved for a $2 billion grant for green finance. You have to ask yourself, is that nonprofit actually equipped to absorb $2 billion? And why was that grant given? And I think those are questions that are easy to answer, that don't necessarily require a legislative solution. What they require is legislative oversight by Congress to hold them accountable. But it also requires a Department of Justice, when appropriate, to consider legal sanction. And I think that's the area where it has been lacking in a lot of these corruption, follow the money scandals that we've seen in Washington, D.C. When you can demonstrate that a crime has been committed, is the DOJ actually prepared to prosecute them? And the evidence seems to be right now pretty limited.
I want to turn to China. You mentioned China. I think it was in Blood Money where you talked about the disintegration strategy that China's using against the United States, which looks like a lot of, you know, death by a thousand cuts, trigger Glocks that they push into the country, and fentanyl, of course, using the Mexican cartels to push that poison into the country. So can you just share with everyone watching what that strategy is, how effective the Chinese have been, and they have been effective at promoting it, and what we're doing now, what is this administration doing or not doing to address it?
Yeah, great questions. You know, disintegration warfare is the term that the Chinese use. There was a book written in 2012 by two military officers. Xi has adopted it. A lot of the military brass has adopted it. And what disintegration warfare basically says is, we are going to engage in warfare against the United States short of a kinetic shooting war. In other words, we don't want to be launching missiles at each other. We don't want troops in trenches fighting, but we are going to engage in actions short of kinetic warfare that damage the United States, that kill Americans, that fragment American society. And some of those are pretty obvious. Fentanyl is one of them. I think one of the biggest misnomers, well, there are really two, about fentanyl is that, number one, this is a Mexican drug cartel operation. It's not. They're the junior partner. It's really a Chinese operation. The precursors for fentanyl come from China. There are 2,000 Chinese chemists, according to the DEA, that turn the precursors into fentanyl for the drug cartels. These 2,000 Chinese chemists live in northern Mexico. The pill presses that the cartels use to make these fentanyl-laced tablets are pill presses that come from China. China has sold them to the drug cartels at cost. The money laundering that the drug cartels do, you know, in the old days of Pablo Escobar, they launder their money through South American banks. They now use Chinese state-owned banks to launder Sinaloa drug cartel money. So this is a Chinese operation. That's the first part of it, and it is part of warfare. The second part that I think people have to understand is what is going on. This is not a typical drug addiction problem. The vast majority of people that are dying of fentanyl poisoning don't even know they're taking fentanyl. It's a college kid who is studying for an exam who is taking an Adderall that somebody says, take this Adderall, it'll help you concentrate. It was something somebody bought on the street thinking it was a real Adderall, and they die of a fentanyl overdose. And it is the leading cause of death in the United States for people under the age of 45. So this is a massively successful program from China's point of view, and we ought to view it as such. But there are other strategies that involve this as well. I mean, look at COVID. You know, I think the evidence is pretty clear that this was a lab leak. But look at what China did even in the months as we were preparing for the outbreak of COVID. The Chinese knew, we now know definitively, they knew at the beginning of November of 2019 that there was this virus and that it was transmissible from person to person. That if two people became in contact, one had it, it would transfer to the other person. They denied that publicly until the end of January, when they finally told the American authorities, hey, by the way, this is transferable from human to human. What did they do in the three-month period that they were lying to us? They corner the market on PPE supplies. They literally cornered the market. So by the time they alerted us to what they already knew, we were hamstrung and they had massive leverage over us. So they took that step and other steps that literally maximized the body count in the United States. So this is where China is coming from. What I like about the approach that Trump is taking is he's essentially taking a holistic approach to China. You have the issue of tariffs, for example, and he talks a lot about the manufacturing a problem and Chinese exports to the United States, and certainly that's part of it. But he's also created this fentanyl tariff on China, on Canada, and on Mexico, and has said, look, you're going to pay a price for this. If you were doing this, we're going to make it at least cost you billions of dollars. So you're paying some price for what you're doing to our people. And I think that is enormously valuable. So at least they are paying some price. I think what you're seeing in the Panama Canal is not just about the Panama Canal. It's the fact that you have Chinese entities that control both sides of the canal. He zeroed in and said, no, we're not going to allow China to do that. If you look at the issue of the Russian invasion of Ukraine and trying to find peace in Ukraine, whatever one thinks that agreement should look like, clearly part of the motivation is to pull Russia away from China, that Russia has been isolated because of their aggressive actions. They're sort of in the fold with China. This, I think, is partly a stratagem to pull Russia away from China to first, you know, to isolate them. And then finally, Trump's strategy on tariffs, he's made pretty clear. He wants to negotiate with everybody before he negotiates with China. And he's using that as leverage to isolate China from other trading partners. So I think that response is very good because I do believe that China is the biggest threat that we face in the United States today. And many of the challenges we face domestically and internationally, there is a China hand involved.
Just a quick accountability question on that before we move on. Your book lays out, I think, pretty clearly the involvement of, let's say, the Biden family and other members of that administration in a lot of these dealings with China and their associated companies. So again, do you think that there will be any accountability for those people's role in this entire mess over the last several years?
I think that that sits on Pam Bondi's desk, and I hope that she makes the right decision, which is to prosecute. And again, I don't say that because I've got something personally against Joe Biden, but it's what I was saying earlier. I mean, here's the cold, hard reality. Yes, Joe Biden is off the political stage. He's gone. But the problem is what Joe Biden did and what his family did was enormously profitable for that family. And I would argue is criminally negligent towards the United States. And so the question is, do you want to deter that behavior in the future? Right? Just because the guy's no longer president doesn't mean the issue's not irrelevant. And I think you do, because if we don't deal with that issue, here's the fundamental reality we face. We face that in the future, we can have a president, a vice president, a secretary of defense, a secretary of state, whose adult family members are taking tens of millions of dollars from our adversaries like China, doing nothing meaningful in exchange. And now this is suddenly acceptable behavior because of the Biden exception. The Bidens did it. Nothing happened to them. Why can't I do the same thing? That's kind of the stakes as far as I'm concerned. So I hope there will be accountability. My recommendation would be that there should be prosecutions. Again, I'm not an attorney, but I think there's clear evidence lying to Congress. I think there's clear evidence of money laundering and other issues. Individuals need to be prosecuted for those, or this kind of behavior is going to be imitated, regardless of political party.
Yeah, I mean, the issue of foreign funds at the upper echelons of our government is obviously a serious one. Qatar is another country that comes to
mind.
And
a bipartisan one.
Yeah. But let me just, I just have one more question about China. And that is, do you worry a little bit that the administration has sort of bit off more than it can chew with these tariffs with China? Are we really ready for a trade war with China? And secondly, you know, you mentioned kind of a united front against China. Wouldn't it have made more sense to sort of turn down the temperature on tariffs vis-a-vis the rest of the world and American allies, create a coalition, isolate China, rather than kind of tariff everybody, China more, but still, I mean, so what is kind of the sequencing here and how do you see this playing out?
Yeah, no, I think that's a fair criticism and a fair point. You know, you can't do everything all at once. And that's essentially what they're trying to do. But, you know, do we really want the United States at a time we're grappling with China to be engaged in trade negotiations with Malaysia? Not saying Malaysia is not important, but yeah, it can be a distraction. It can muddle things. So I do think there are things that could have been done differently that I would have done differently. But I would say that being said, it is actually being done. And I do believe that, you know, a lot of the complaining on Wall Street, which is sort of being amplified by a lot of the mainstream media, I think is exaggerated. And I think that China has far, far, far more to lose with a ruptured trade relationship or a limited trade relationship than the United States does. We see the prospects of higher cost goods. They face the prospects of massive unemployment. And you're already seeing that. The Wall Street Journal reporting, I think today or yesterday, they're shuttering entire factories in China. Because the Chinese built an economy whose bedrock remains the export of goods to the United States. So they need us a lot more than we need them. I don't say that to argue that there should be a complete severing of the relationship. I don't say that. But the time is definitely, I think, with the United States and not with China. And I do think we are probably going to see a trade deal with China. My caveat is always, will they honor that trade agreement? You know, there were agreements Trump made in the first term, one of them being fentanyl. Remember, Xi said after the dinner in Mar-a-Lago in 2017, he was going to fix the fentanyl crisis. He didn't. He flat out lied about it. There was a trade agreement that the United States had signed with China in terms of purchasing American goods. The Chinese threw that by the wayside. So I think this is not going to have a quick fix. On the other hand, I think we don't really have a choice. And I think what you're seeing from Wall Street and from the tech community, I understand why they're doing it. They have exposed themselves to the Chinese market. It's one of their big growth areas. But they are being used by Beijing. Because let's remember, when Trump started this in 2017, the first thing Chinese diplomats did is they didn't go to the White House. They didn't meet with the trade advisors. They went to Wall Street and they went to Silicon Valley and said, you guys are going to go to Washington and petition upon our behalf. And I think we have to keep that in mind with any of the rhetoric that's coming out of Wall Street or Silicon Valley about these trade issues.
Peter, another place that China and Qatar and other countries who are not necessarily our friends or don't act that way have invested a lot of their money is in American academia. And you've written and spoken a lot about that. I think what bothers me most about this conversation is it's not news. People think it's news now, but we've known about this for decades, the non-reporting of the elite institutions about the money that comes in. I don't know what to ask you other than, do you see the spotlight on it now maybe changing the public perception of what's been happening, that will actually change the reality going forward? Or is it just a moment in the news and it'll just keep rolling on?
It's a good question. I mean, this is another area where I think you can actually see legal sanction because laws have been broken. We know, for example, it's crystal clear, universities in the United States are required by federal law to disclose foreign donations that they receive. And that has been on the book for decades. And we know that universities have not disclosed those donations. In some cases, they have simply ignored reporting them all entirely. So the question is, if there's a law on the books and these schools are violating them, should there not be some legal sanction that they incur because of that? I think they should. The second problem, though, I think is making sure that they are abiding by the intentions of the law. The law is very clear. The law says if you receive money from China, everybody needs to know, the government needs to know, the public elite needs to know that you are receiving, you know, $100 million from Chinese interests. But what a lot of the schools do is when they do report it, they purposely deceive the origins of those funds.
They run them through Canada and other countries. I think you wrote in the book. Yeah, I read the book.
Exactly right. Exactly right. Qatar does the same thing. So you have Li Keqing, who is a Hong Kong billionaire, very close to the CCP. In fact, his company is the one that owns the entranceways to the Panama Canal that's raising so much concern. He gives millions of dollars to the University of California at Berkeley. So it's Chinese money. It's coming from him. But he set up a foundation in Canada. So Berkeley lists it as a Canadian donation, when everybody knows it's not a Canadian donation. It's the same thing with Joe Tsai. Joe Tsai is the executive chairman of Alibaba, the sort of the Amazon of China. He's also very close to the CCP. He defends them. He defends the communist regime there. He set up a foundation in a tax shelter in a place called Guernsey. It's an island offshore from the UK. So Yale, which has received, I believe it's $300 million over the course of the last, 5 or 10 years from Joe Tsai, those donations are listed as coming from Guernsey, not from China. To me, that is a flagrant violation of that law. You are trying to conceal the origins of that money. And I think we need to have the Department of Education and the Department of Justice say, you know what? You're going to pay a price for that. If you're not going to abide by a simple disclosure rule, we're not saying you can't take the money. We're not telling you what you can do with the money. We're asking you to simply disclose the money you're receiving. If you can't even abide by that, you are going to face sanction until you do.
Great. Peter Schweitzer, thank you so much for joining us today.
It was a pleasure. Thanks so much. Great questions. And I enjoy the great work that the New York Sun continues to do.
Great. Thank you
so much.